You're listening to the Youth Critic Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at DecibelUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at DecibelUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network. And now for the podcast.
I came home, there was a man in my house. He had an artificial arm.
Are you saying that I killed my wife? Are you saying that I crushed her skull? And that I shot her?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospectives. I am your host, Kel Smith. Joining me on this venture is Justin Mayhew.
Hello, you all, you cadets from outer space.
And today we are going to be talking about The Fugitive with Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee.
And a very angry freight train.
Yep. Lots of trains in this movie.
There are, actually.
The train is a secret Alfred Hitchcock cameos.
Yes.
But yeah, so we are kind of jumping ahead because there's not really that. There was a Sean Connery film that came out. I mean, there was some stuff that came out like on the last weekend of July of 1993, but it was just like, it's not really worth doing a retrospective over, and I kind of just wanted to get to The Fugitive. So here we are, and on top of that, we're on time because we're releasing it on the actual anniversary of The Fugitive. So we're going to be talking about that today. So Justin, what's your history with The Fugitive?
Well, I did see it in the theaters when it first came out, and I thought that the aforementioned train wreck was a pretty efficiently and impressively staged bit of action. And, of course, the obvious, you know, swan dive off of the dam everybody thinks about, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, The Fugitive, it's interesting because I have just only seen this movie for the podcast, even though it's a staple action thriller classic. It's part of that 90s trend of, well, let's adapt, you know, TV shows into movies.
Yeah, sort of a forerunner of our remake fever that we have now, you know?
Right. And I could not see. Maybe I should have watched at least an episode or two of the show before, but I couldn't imagine this being a TV show.
Yeah, it's. I've actually seen a couple of the episodes, not all the way through, but I'm acquainted with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very 60s. And if you're not a real super 60s nerd, it's going to be kind of an issue to get through, you know. And also the whole thing about the one-armed man, this whole Kimball character in the 60s and in this version is loosely or popularly believed to be loosely based on a Dr. Shepard in the late 50s who was accused of killing his wife and blamed it on a bushy-haired man. Well, not one-armed, but he had bushy hair. So it's sort of loosely based on a real-life trial expose, as most people think. The creator of the show said he didn't, but, you know, well, who knows?
Well, I mean, subconsciously he probably heard about it and then forgot the source material. I mean, things happen.
Sure. I mean, you hear that in music all the time where, you know, somebody uses a melody and it turns out to be somebody else's melody, like the the ex-Beatles, what's his name? Hallelujah?
Paul McCartney?
No. He was the...
John Lennon?
No. Not Ringo. The last,
I don't know what that other one is. That guy.
Yeah,
we'll
that
just
guy.
Say that guy.
Frappy Lappy Dappy. He had the biggest hits after the band broke up. Mm-hmm. But his song Hallelujah, Howdy Krishna, Hallelujah, was accused of being stolen from a Motown song. You know, that whole big trial about that.
Oh, boy. Yeah, so for me, The Fugitive, I've just seen it for the first time, and...
Freshly.
I think the issue is with this movie is it's still very well made. Like, Andrew Davis, you know, and we'll get into the production history in a little bit, but Andrew Davis does make a competent movie. It is a really good screenplay. And
by David Twohy.
Mm-hmm. And Jeb Stuart, the co-writer of Die Hard. And it's a real, and I mean, it's a well-made movie, and it feels more authentic than, let's say, maybe the Taken movies or some of the more over-the-top Luc Besson joints of this kind of premise.
those Taken movies, I refuse to watch those.
Yeah. So, I mean, I mean, it's a good movie, but I think the problem with The Fugitive is everyone's kind of taken, like, a stab at, you know, that story or that kind of premise in some shape or form, and it's always the clicking top, you know, ticking clock. It's all, or the conspiracy, and it makes for a good story, but it makes for a cheap, you know, action movie. But in this day and age, it's like it's been kind of overdone. So of course, when I get to this, The Fugitive, which is, you know, basically the start of it all, it's like, it's like watching the Maltese Falcon after being exposed to so many TV procedurals and crime shows. It's like being exposed to, you know, that old Humphrey Bogart movie, and you're going, oh, this is where it began.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not interesting. I'm sorry.
Oh, really? I would highly recommend that you go out and watch the Maltese Falcon right now, I would say.
I mean, it's a like this one, it's a great movie, but or it's a really good movie. It's just, I think you're just burned. And I think that's the problem of constantly redoing premises over and over and over, is that you just burn the future audiences of who's going to, you know, eventually stumble upon, like, a Maltese Falcon or this. You're going to stumble upon this problem of where they're going to be like, well, like, it's well done, but I kind of could tell you where it was going to go. Like, from after the first 40 minutes, I could tell you where it was going to end.
I've had that with a lot of movies, I'm afraid, you know. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, with, like, The Maltese Falcon and The Big Sleep, come on, those are, you know, that's classic right there. I can't knock those.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good story. And it is very interesting. And Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones, who only share a couple minutes on screen together, do have a really good bickering throughout the whole movie, or create a foil, because one's trying to catch the other, one's trying to leave the other. I mean, it's very interesting how they almost intersect, and he's almost caught, and in a way, it's a really interesting story. Although even though I just watched the movie, I couldn't tell you what was the reasoning for the villain to frame this all on Richard?
Because he wasn't going to go along. It's a pretty paper-thin excuse, but the idea was that they're rushing this new vascular disease. Yeah, for helping with heart attacks and things like that, but it caused liver damage, and they're trying to cover it up. But it's such a massive cover-up and such massive liver damage that they were going to be exposed pretty quickly anyway. And so Dr. Richard Kimball standing in the way of this thing is going to crumble like a house of cards, you know, pretty quickly, even without him, you know. So their back plot that they're trying to cover up the liver damage that this new wonder drug does is pretty, you know, slapdash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the film... Okay, so I was kind of... offer a drug that would fall apart instantly. Okay,
yep.
Whatever. I mean, the Mission Impossible movies have had crazier things that have crazier MacGuffins. So, but yeah, that's kind of my whole thing about this movie is it's a really good movie.
It's well paced. It's well directed. Well acted. But I do have some character issues. You know,
well, go ahead, because I don't have that much to say.
Right.
On
well, I, you know, how Richard Kimball is, you know, the put upon man, And, you know, nobody believes him, but he's such a good man. And they show it repeatedly. He saves the guard and he saves the prisoner. You know,
saves
from
the kid.
Yeah, saves the kid. And that there's like the most obvious thing where here's a vascular surgeon who, you know, works in a very particular thing, comes into an emergency room and immediately can detect a disease that this emergency room doctor hasn't seen. And quite frankly, first off, there's an issue with that because a vascular surgeon is not an emergency room doctor. Those are completely different environments with completely different stressors, you know?
Right.
And secondly, it kind of makes me think that Dr. Richard Kimball is what they call a Gary Stu. Have you ever heard of that?
Explain that for the listener.
Okay, Gary Stu is the male version of the Mary Sue, the perfect character who has a terrible life that everybody loves, but they're so, oh, she's such a wonderful person, but so these terrible things have happened
and
to her.
He or she is empowered.
Yeah, that they become disempowered and have to regain their power through showing what a great and kind and merciful person they are. You know, it's almost an avatar of the writer showing, you know, I'm a great guy. You know, this character is sort of an avatar of me. You know, look how great of a guy. I'm so misunderstood, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's important to show throughout the film multiple times that Kimball is innocent, because, I mean, maybe it would have been more interesting if Kimball was, like, just going crazy, and he was doing, and that was the twist, was he was going insane trying to find this person, but ultimately it's himself. But I think the film is trying very hard to be like, no, it's not, you know.
Sure, but I'm very, Kimball. Yeah, I'm just very sensitive to that. If they could push it a little too far for me, I think let the character's general actions speak for themselves. It's also another thing. Have you heard of kick the dog, pet the dog?
Explain that for the listener, too.
Okay. Kick the dog, pet the dog is a trope where the good guy finds a puppy or a kitten, and they pick it up, and they stroke it, they pet it, they feed it, they treat it nice. And
to humanize the character.
Yeah, and then the bad guy, you know, comes up and slaps or smacks or crashes or punches, sometimes literally kicking the dog. An example was in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the classic spaghetti western with Clint Eastwood, where he's sitting waiting for the other gang members to come, and they're watching the Union Army go by through this shelled-out town, and he's got a couple of kittens sitting in his hat. He's just sitting there rubbing these kittens, you know, petting these kittens in his hat, waiting.
Right.
And that's an example of pet the dog, kick the dog, right there. And that's what it means. It's a shorthand to show a good or bad character. And, you know, they're useful to show good or bad in a very shorthand way, but it's easy to put a lot, you know, like you put a lot of mayonnaise in a sandwich and overpower it sometimes.
Right.
You
know? Right, so where does that fit here?
Well, it's that, you know, like he goes and helps the boy in the thing. It's the Gary Stu and the pet the dog and kick the dog are kind of ham-handed, you know, like super shorthand ways of showing a good or a bad character. And, you know, it's necessary, you know, to show in shorthand ways. The tropes are there for a reason.
Right.
You know, cliches and tropes work for a reason. But you can't, you have to be careful and judicious about their application. You know, a little sprinkle of balsamic vinaigrette on your salad is good, but you swim that sucker in it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, it's the same of, you know, Caesar dressing on a salad.
Right.
Or, the Big Mac sauce on the Big Mac.
I think there may be a little too much dressing on this movie, man.
Yeah. But, yeah, I agree. But, I mean, I understand the point of it. I understand, like, and of course, and this is a very studio friendly.
Oh yes.
This is a, you know, I mean, this is Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones.
Right.
So I mean, they.
Oh, and a nice little bonus, Joey Pantaleone, who's going to later on be the bad guy from The Matrix.
Well, the bad guy in a lot of movies.
Yeah. This time he's playing a subordinate good guy.
Yeah. But. Well, and on this one, the fugitive. It's very like I was kind of looking through the production history of this, and Andrew Davis turned in a first cut after, you know, months of filming, like through the winter of 92 and 93, and everyone was like, "Don't cut a frame, it's great." Well, there was still 1600 cuts of the movie to try and get the movie down to its pace and get it down to its 2-hour intimate level.
But it just kind of shows you how studio friendly this was, or the movie is, because people just genuinely liked the film and they genuinely bought into Harrison Ford's performance. And
yeah, it's a pretty good vehicle. I mean, I complain, but it is, you look at it on paper and in production, it's the perfect Harrison Ford vehicle.
Well, it's the perfect star vehicle.
Pardon?
It's a perfect star vehicle.
Right, but Harrison Ford fits into it pretty well, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, let's just say, let's put Matthew McConaughey in this.
No. I disagree wholeheartedly. You give me that, I stab you in the eye for that. No, I don't. Matthew McConaughey, not a Harrison Ford. He's, man, I know Harrison Ford, man. He is no Harrison Ford, man.
But here's the but
and of course, I lied about that.
But I'm saying, like, this is as an example, this is a good star vehicle, you know, because the good guy is doing good, but he's, you know, walking through the woods. He's like, he's kind of sort of false revenanting it, if you remember that, the false revenant.
Revenant. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Where.
Well, yeah, there is this, you know,
he's in the woods.
Yeah, he's been stabbed. He actually has been stabbed.
Yeah.
You know, he's in the woods, freezing. It's the wintertime. Supposed to be in the south of Illinois.
He jumps in the river.
He jumps in the river like twice. You know.
Yeah. And, I mean, he's jumping. It's like a good, you know, little.
And he's
ego
making
boost.
Little. He's in the mound. He's doing his little survival skills from the Eagle Scouts, or he makes a little mound of leaves to cover himself up in the night, you know, when he's sleeping.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, you know, I don't want to say ego-driven, but it's very bravado-driven.
Yeah, like, it's...
like, look at me, I'm tough.
The tough Lone Ranger kind of thing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's a libertarian streak.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's another thing with it I think is interesting. It's set all in Illinois, but the vast majority of the countryside scenes were shot in North Carolina. In Tennessee.
That explains why there's no snow in Chicago.
Yeah. And there's also a lot of mountains in Illinois. In actual Illinois, there are no mountains.
It's pretty flat.
In the south of Illinois, you got hills that are close to what you get around here.
Right.
Yeah, but you don't get the Smoky Mountains, people. You know, there are no mountains in Illinois.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was wondering is, you know, watching the movie, I'm like, where's all this fucking snow?
Yeah, they shot, you know, the train crash?
Uh-huh.
The physical set, not the model, the physical set is still there. Where they shot it in Dillsboro, North Carolina.
Yeah, and I think it's the tourist.
Yeah, people go and photograph themselves with it. Mm-hmm. It's just been sitting there for close to 30 years now, you know.
So I wonder, do you think it was just it would have just been too much to pick it up or clean it up, or do you think they were just like, fuck it, no, let's leave it?
I'm inclined to the latter.
Yeah.
Eh, fuck it.
Yeah, it's in the middle of, where is it at? Oh. We'll just
it's an improvement to this little podunk town.
Yeah. Okay. Lord, it would have been something if that movie bombed.
Well, but it didn't, so we didn't have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean it did well enough. I remember seeing the theaters were fairly well, you know.
I was kind of in the reason why I was saying that it would have been a shame if the movie bombed, because now that train that's just there for no reason
and nobody would care then. Yeah, but now it's a tourist attraction and. The locals probably do make a buck or two selling them lattes and things. You know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, go for that town, you know. Yeah.
But, yeah, the countryside scene, the dam, the train crash, the chases through the woods.
The hospital. Yeah, hospital stuff.
Yeah, the country hospital, you know. It's supposed to be Southern Illinois, but it's actually in North Carolina, Tennessee area.
That is a hell of a trek for one person to go from Southern Illinois to.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever like traveled through the state of Illinois.
I used to live in Illinois.
Okay. So you probably know if you wanted to go from what's a town in South Illinois?
Shelbyville, Cairo.
Okay. If you want to go from there to Chicago, how long do you think it would take?
Oh, like 4 or 5 hours.
Oh, really?
By driving, yeah.
Oh, really? I thought it was like 8 hours.
No, it's about 6 or 7 to do the entire state.
Okay.
You know, but our trip from Georgia to Illinois every Christmas would take us an average of pure driving about 12 to 14 hours. Okay. But, you know, we since we're a whole bunch of different people, we'd stop and go pee and eat at different hours and get coffee at different places. So it would normally take us, you know, 17 or 18. But if you're driving like a bat out of hell from here to Champaign, Urbana, it'd take you about maybe 10, 12 hours.
And this is driving in. Was it? God, I'm already kind of forgetting this movie. I'm terrible. Did they imply that Kimball rode a train up there or rode a bus, something other than just walking? Because it, from what I remember,
he picked rides. He was hitchhiking. Remember? Yeah, he was hitchhiking from the south. They were transporting him to a southern facility in the south of the state when they crashed, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was where he was going to meet his execution.
Well, he was going to prison before, I mean, because it usually takes years, you know.
Right.
He was going to the facility in the southern portion of the state, yes. And they were mostly there. They said it was going to take them about 40 minutes to get to the facility right before they crashed.
Yeah.
Before they were hijacked by the other prisoners, of course. Those wily prisoners always stabbing those prison guards, always. It's always happening, you know.
Oh, yeah. I always feel terrible for prison guards.
Well, they're exploiters of the masses. Yeah. But no, so they were in the south of Illinois. So you're talking by car. If you got on the freeway, and now surface streets like they showed would take you a little bit longer. You know, if you're taking from, say, St. Louis, where he claimed to be in the phone call, he was in Chicago, you're talking like 3 or 4 hours by freeway. But if you're driving the surface streets, you know, in the back roads, a little longer, you know. Mm-hmm. But so you see him hitchhiking for a couple of days to get to Chicago.
I mean, there's no ticking time clock here. I mean, it's just whenever.
No, his wife is dead, so there's no.
We're hiding your wife in the basement of some. Yeah,
there's no
alleyway.
Nuclear. There's no Jack Ryan nuclear bomb going to go off in Bethesda, Maryland, or something.
Yeah. And it's always moody. Like the movie itself is just moody.
Yeah, I actually do appreciate the moody, gritty kind of procedural way it moves.
Uh-huh.
I do appreciate the pacing. I think the pacing is fairly spot on. You know, it has spots of action. You know, things do explode.
Yeah.
But then you have some nice bits of poppy dialogue where they, you know, taunt each other. Like the right before the swan dive in the dam, they had their little exchange. I don't care. You know.
Yeah.
So there's some nice time for the dialogue to play out. You know.
Yeah, it's a. Yeah, and then I mean, you have the banter in the marshal's room, or you know, with Tommy and Joe and all the other cast members in there, you know, and there, and you know, they feel at times like a team.
Is it who is the agent that was held hostage by the other prisoner? Was it Brad Dourif or Stephen Dorfman, somebody like that? Brad Dourif, the blonde agent.
It did look like Brad Dourif.
Somebody like that. And when he shoots right next to him and shoots at the fugitive who's holding him hostage, that would be my last day as a federal marshal. Fuck you guys. I quit. I'm going to work in my drywall business with my brother, okay?
Yeah.
No more of that crap.
Well, and also, you know, and also, to me, I feel like Tommy Lee Jones's character, Gerard, has an arc. In that he goes from this, you know, just fuck it, I don't care. I'm here to do a service. I'll do it. And you see that in the scene where he murders the other ex-convict that escaped.
Yep.
But throughout the movie, he learns shit. Like this whole thing is a complete clusterfuck that I didn't even know. And now it's my kind of obligation as an officer of the law to, you know, figure it out.
Speaking of Tommy Lee Jones' character arcs, two things. I did find him kind of an annoying character. You know, you can't say hinky. I'll say hinky whenever I want to, asshole. You know? And secondly, did you know about the sequel?
Oh, is it U.S. Marshals?
Yes, with Tommy Lee Jones and Wesley Snipes as the fugitive in this case.
No.
Not as good of a film. Not as good as a film. not as well made.
So that's interesting they made a sequel of that, because, because I mean, Tommy Lee Jones' character is not the main character, even though he has the most defined arc in the movie, in that he goes from this, you know, like I said.
That is a good point, yes. But it kind of makes sense then, too, because they couldn't afford for the lowered budget of the sequel to get Harrison Ford back.
But I mean, even that, like, what would Harrison Ford even do in the sequel, so.
Yeah. But people expect things, you know.
Right.
And you know, it's sort of an obvious shoot-off, the extension of how many sequels have you seen where the first movie, there's a love arc There's a romantic arc to the film, and the love interest of the first film disappears in the second. Recently, when we did Weekend at Bernie's 1 and Weekend at Bernie's 2, this was supposed to be like 2 days later, and Richard's love interest...
It's gone. Mary,
yeah, poof. Like, he doesn't have any clue about her existence anymore. She's been swallowed into a black hole of oblivion or something.
She's out of movie land.
Yes, and I really find that frustrating, you know?
Yeah.
And they do it so wantonly that the woman is not a character. She's a prop, just to be thrown away.
She's a plot device.
Yes, and I really find it frustrating, you know?
And going into the Mission Impossible movies a little bit, that was always my problem with Mission Impossible 3, is that Michelle Monaghan, who is a great actress, it's a criminal we underuse her. Every director should be prosecuted for underusing her.
I agree, and I think that another one that gets sorely misunderstood and misused and underused, Michelle Rodriguez.
Mm-hmm.
She gets so many little bit parts and things. She could be a serious action movie contender.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she knows how to play with the big boys.
Right. And I think she could be a real action star. The only time I've ever seen her in a lead was a really weird, ridiculous movie where she plays the dude that gets a sex change operation.
Oh.
The action movie.
Oh, that Walter Hill movie.
Yeah, was that Walter Hill, yes. And they have her, at the beginning, they have her with a prosthetic penis, wearing an actual prosthetic penis. And they have this full frontal nudity of this fake male character. Yes, and then they have her get a sex change and turn her into a woman. It's like... Yes, this is a really tortured logic to this movie here, you know?
That sounds bad.
It's so bad, but it's a fascinating train wreck. It's a fascinating train wreck.
Also, that's very transphobic.
It is, it is. There are a lot of issues with that movie. But I recommend it, if not for us, it's an oddity, like sort of like the Circus Sideshow Freak Show. You have to look it up and find out the name. Let me look it up and I'll find the name of that one, and you can tell us something else about Tommy Lee Jones or something.
So interestingly enough, we talked about last week. Another Stakeout was another production that had shot from January to April and then released in July. This too also got a rush post, primarily because the studio was loving what they were seeing. Because I think this movie, it doesn't specifically say when it was originally supposed to come out, but I'm assuming it was supposed to come out like in November or Christmas of 1993. And then they literally like pushed it up as far as they could because they literally only had stopped filming at the end of April.
And then there was the rush to meet the deadline that they had superimposed on The Last Action Hero, too. So there's a lot of rushed. Here's this film here.
The Assignment.
Walter Hill, was it that directed it?
He was.
Yeah.
Right there, the bot.
Yeah, Walter Hill. But it's an interesting... I recommend you watch it because it's a fascinating exploration of how interesting things can go wrong with a film. And it is an intriguing... plot.
Failure.
Yeah, an intriguing plot and intriguing failure. So I recommend The Assignment in 2016 by Walter Hill and Michelle Rodriguez. And if you watch it for nothing else, it's to see her full frontal nudity with a gigantic fake schlong, a big fake prosthetic penis. It's hilarious. The thing hangs down to her knee, I swear.
Oh my god.
It's outrageous. It's so fun. You need to have a cocktail when you see it, you know.
Oh my god. We're
or something
off
stronger. Anyway, we're sidetracked about, you know, characters that get, you know, sidelined, which came from Harrison Ford of all places to Michelle Rodriguez wearing a fake penis.
So anyway, that was my issue. So yeah, I mean, that was the thing, wasn't the time, was they literally were editing all summer,
get the bam, 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 to get it.
Yeah. At one point, there was six editors on the movie, working two different Avid machines, and everyone was just compiling the movie.
Yeah, 93, together. This is before we did the whole computer, nonlinear, you know.
Yeah, I'm, you know.
They're still using physical machines at the time, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting about today versus back then, there's not that many productions that just go from... There's not that many more productions anymore that go from, like, we're going to shoot till April and then release in June or right. July.
Right. I mean, usually, this is not a 100% thing, but usually you shoot in the summer or the fall, then you have all winter and most of the spring to post-produce. Generally speaking, mm-hmm. you know, that's average, you know. You shoot in 1 year, like say you shoot in 2012, right. then you release it sometime later in 2013,
yeah.
you know, say, for instance, right? You know?
Yeah, it's like we kind of, even though, and I do the, you know, air quote thing, everything's gone faster in editing and linear editing, yeah. but the
problem... Right, well, you have, you know, Lightbox and Apple... Adobe Premiere is the big one now.
Avid. Yeah. Or...
Avid. There's so many different programs. Vegas. There's so many different programs you can. And you just basically dump. Now
Final
since everybody
Cut
shoots.
Pro, that's what I was thinking of.
Final Cut.
Yeah.
A Final Cut. But, you know, all these different options you have. You basically shoot on digital, dump it to a camera, and you can see your footage the same day you shoot it, you know.
Yeah.
And get a rough cut. You can get a rough cut before you're even done shooting everything, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it is, but we still have, you know... movies that, you know, take 8 months to post. And not saying that every director should just be like, you should be able to edit your movie in a week.
Right. Well, I mean, if you have an effects heavy, a fantasy, sci-fi kind of thing,
you're
going to have a lot of post-production to do the digital effects.
Which happened over the years.
Right, yeah. You have, a superhero movie isn't going to be, you know, released a week after a shot. You know?
I just find it hilarious that now that technology has finally kept up to where we can do multiple cuts, we can do effects. The post has even gone longer and longer.
Yeah. Well, and the more you rely on computers, the more you can do in post. You know, really. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, even our comedies have, like, tons of CGI shots.
And I have no problem with post. Post, to me, is where you're really bringing everything together. You've got the whole recipe kind of stewing and fomenting and letting all these ideas kind of gel and all this stuff. The longer you take, sometimes, you know, it gives you some more time to breathe and let the edit breathe and stuff. So, you know, I think a long post-production is not bad. You know?
Oh, no, I've never, I mean, I don't complain about long posts. I mean, it's, even as a filmmaker, we're both filmmakers. And
I say I am.
Well, we've made shorts. Okay. We've made shorts.
We've worked with cameras. We've worked with Avid and...
Adobe,
and
we're recording
Vegas.
On Adobe right now.
Yep.
I mean, it's just interesting that like productions were like, okay, yeah, go ahead and just do this and do this and do this and do this, and we'll have the movie out in 3 months.
Yep.
It's just
that's crazy. That's crazy stuff, though. There, right there. That's crazy. Yeah.
It is. I think the Mission Impossible movies are the last of those movies that still do. Like, they'll shoot till February or March and then release in late July. I think the new one and then the one before it were both, like, they finished...
Rogue Nation was the last one, yeah.
And then Fallout, they both had...
Yeah.
But the thing I would point out in those movies is that they're editing while they're making the movie. So
sure. Right. And I've seen that. You get somebody on set with an Apple,
right.
You know, and they got... in that case, it'd be Final Cut. But then you get somebody with a Windows machine. They got Adobe, and they're on set. They're shooting. You have the director and the cinematographer and the actors on one side of the house, you know, shooting something. And in the kitchen, there's the editor putting the rough cut together.
Yep. And sometimes they're seeing the movie even before they're done filming.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's like, the first I ever heard of that was the mid-thousandsies movie, the Zodiac, the Fisher.
Fincher's
the Zodiac movie.
David Fincher.
But the Zodiac was one of my favorite movies from him because it had such a real real thing that happened.
It's an authentic take on it.
And it's a very well and thoroughly researched movie. You know, there's a lot of detail in the film.
Mm-hmm. And through all that research, that movie still doesn't give you like a definitive answer.
No. But it's a very good movie. I think it's David Fincher's best movie by far. But anyway, the point was that was the first I'd ever heard about that he's shooting digital and they're dumping and even showing rudimentary special effects on the same day. They have a guy doing green screen fills and rough computer renders of artificial skylines and things like that for the 1960s version of the San Francisco skyline. The day they shoot it, they have a rough render of the special effects on the day they shoot it. It's like, oh, hey, this, and that was the first time I was going like, fuck film. Digital is the motherfucking way to go. You know?
That, and yeah. Fincher would agree with you because he's just been like, I'm just investing in the future. I don't.
Yeah, I'm fully on board with the let's dump this goddamn stupid bullshit 19th century film goddamn shit and shoot on 21st century technology. And Christopher Nolan can go fuck himself.
Not to get on a film versus digital argument.
Because this
digital.
Was shot on film.
Yeah, not to get on a film versus digital argument, but I'm okay with where we're at with the film and digital place. I mean, I would love for one day, like, they make a 14K camera. Like, I mean, I know we're getting there.
Right, they're up to 8K, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, but, oh yeah, I mean, they just came out with the Red Helium a year ago, year or two ago.
Yeah, well, if they get into the 16K territory, you're going to get to pretty close to 35 millimeter, roughly. You know, it's all arbitrary.
Well, 6K but, is 35 millimeter pixel anyway.
Yeah, but then you've got, you know, the 70 millimeter films and things.
Right. Which, I mean, they always rendered through the 8K process anyway when they do. So, I mean, we're at the point where we're here, you know, with digital technology. You know, really the only thing I find that needs to be worked on more is developing more cameras that have like the space that can hold.
It's raw memory.
Yeah, raw memory.
Yeah.
Because when you shoot on 8K, I mean, literally after two shots, you literally have to go take that drive out, and then, you know, you have to have like a 20 drives on standby.
Right, or build like a 10 terabyte drive that goes into the camera.
Right. Right. Yeah, and so shooting on 8K, it looks great. And, you know, and it will be the future, but I think the more we work on memory storage and improving that and making it more compact, because right now, like, I mean, even this computer can't hold, you know, like, I might be able to shoot 1 second in 8K and put it on this computer before it crashes. that's how detailed it is.
Yeah. I mean, just the massive, the exponential increase in file size because of that, you know.
Right.
Anyway.
Oh, The Fugitive.
Richard Kimble, yes. Mr. Train Crash. At the end, they have their big shootout scene, the foot chase through the Hilton in Chicago. Mm-hmm.
Where they're having the little convention to sell the provascular pill.
Yeah. I think it's actually named something like Provaskin or something, isn't it?
I think. I mean, I heard it named Provascular.
Yeah.
So I mean, they're having this foot chase, and they're all over this fucking building because, you know, it's a fucking movie.
Yeah. From the ballroom to the personal suites to the roof to the laundry, elevator shafts. Yep.
Yeah, and then it ends in a dark place where very kind of not completely similar, but very aesthetically similar to where Jones and Ford met in the tunnel. Like they met
in the bowels of a hotel instead of the bowels of a dam. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, in the bowels of, you know, that hotel, they find the truth. They find, they basically read out the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so really interesting direction from Andrew Davis.
Yep.
It kind of bums me that Andrew Davis didn't make any more, hasn't made a movie since 2006 with The Guardian with Kevin Costner and Ashton Kutcher.
That was a fun movie to be watched drunk. And then there's also the fact that Dr. Nichols, who turns out to be the big bad, of course he's a red herring that he acts like the good, like a friend.
Yeah.
In the first half of the film, it turns out to be the big bad, and he's all subterfugious that he, you know, hides his actions and
does his bad actions through. Drop.
Right, but through the whole movie, he has other people do all his nefarious things for him, and then at the very end of the movie, he comes out and just becomes, you know, a badass and starts, you know, clunking people in the head and taking guns and becoming an action kind of dude. after the whole time he's been like a kind of behind the scenes kind of a guy, you know, and he right. handily at the end becomes Mr. Action, you know, mm-hmm. and so kind of overplays his card. Handy enough while the U.S. Marshal is there, I could foresee, you know, that maybe you could excuse it as his adrenaline was flowing or something like that. But you could also see the character doing something like, oh, help me, this guy, he come in, he accosted me, he's got a gun, and try to frame up Dr. Kimball again. You know, you could see that kind of a more of a wormy thing too. You know what I mean?
He could, but then again, I think he was done for. I mean, I think Tommy Lee Jones had kind of put it together what was happening.
Sure, but that would also give Tommy Lee Jones more character, you know, of a snap arc. That there's the you know, the put it two and two together, and it would make it, you know, a little more obvious. Maybe I think it's just a little too facile to have Nichols suddenly become a man of action after he's hidden behind his desk the entire movie, you know?
Right.
And like I said, you can explain it. It's not impossible. It's just handy that the screenwriters wrote it that way, you know?
Well, it should also be known that Tommy Lee Jones did uncredited rewrites for this movie. So it makes a little sense when you now know that.
Especially when you hear he's got a lot more dialogue than maybe he would have, right?
Yeah, because this is, you know, I understand why, of course, Tommy Lee Jones, he's going to get second billing, but still, it's a little bit like, you know, this movie would be like 10, 15 minutes shorter if we didn't have so many of these scenes.
Right.
Which kind of just led to my final problem, which is, even though the movie is well-paced, it still feels very long. To me, and it feels long, I think, because you're just waiting for the shoe to drop. You're waiting for everybody to kind of connect the dots, and I don't know, it just took a little too long for me. I was like,
well, it's interesting to say that, because so many of these action and superhero movies now are like 2.5 hours long and things.
And I think, you know, they're better paced.
Oh. Well, they're overstuffed, if that's what you mean.
No, I mean, like, they're better paced. Like, they consistently are entertaining throughout the whole piece. Like, really, the only scene that I felt like that was well paced was the opening. Like, 14 minutes where they're just going through that, you know, the confession to the trial to on the bus.
Which I thought was a little too fastly paced. It's almost a montage.
Yeah.
I thought the pacing of the rest of the movie was more appropriate, actually.
Really?
Yes. And these movies, the superhero movies, oftentimes, outside of like the Thor Ragnarok, which had kind of a weird kind of off the wall, almost a Barbarella, Flash Gordon kind of a feel, mm-hmm. you know, which it kind of stuck out. The rest of the Avenger, X-Men, they all run together. I have a terrible time keeping them a track from one another, because all the action is very similar and very similar put together. And I lose track of these superhero movies so easily and so quickly, mm-hmm. you know.
It's machine work, or it's, you know, factory.
I mean, how many Iron Mans are there now? Three or four?
Three.
Okay.
There are three.
I haven't seen Avengers yet. I'll probably watch it shortly, because it's now on digital.
Yeah.
I'll probably watch it in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, I mean, overall, like the Avengers, the Winter Soldier, what's some others? I couldn't tell you what happened in each one. I've seen them all. You know,
I can, but that's because I guess that's because I'm invested in this series.
Yeah, I'm not a big, you know, the last superhero movie that I really honestly actually liked was the first Batman.
The Tim Burton Batman.
Yes. 1989 was the last time I liked a superhero movie.
That reminds me. We should do a Batman retrospective.
Do all of them?
Wait a minute.
The 1966 Batman?
Damn it, I already did that one. I already did the Batman movies.
Damn it, Robin! We've been foiled again!
Maybe we can do a redo. Because it's been...
Hey, everybody else is rebooting everything. Why not?
Maybe we will do a redo because, A, that summer of 1989 looking pretty good.
Batman, the retrospective, the reboot.
You know, now that I'm thinking about it, wink, wink, the summer of 1989 might be next season of this.
The next retrospective, 89?
Wink, wink. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we won't do it. Maybe we'll do 99 or something. Who knows?
Hey, you're the boss, man. you're the boss. I just watch him.
Cool. Wink, 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 wink.
Anyway, I think it's an acceptable action film, The Fugitive. I would give it roughly 3 out of 5 stars, roughly.
Yeah, I would give it 3 out of 5, too, because it is well made. Like, I think Andrew Davis never leaves the subject, never takes us out of the subjectiveness of Richard Kimball. And also, and regardless of what I say about the pace, like, the plot still moves forward with every scene. It's not like,
yeah,
there, it's not like there's fat or there's like a scene where, you know.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, I think, bear with me here for a second.
Uh-huh.
You recall The Silence of the Lambs, I'm sure.
Yes.
I think that actually they're similarly paced.
Right.
There's a lot of buildup. There's a lot of investigation. There's a lot of background and a lot of atmosphere that they use mm-hmm. to get the places.
There's a lot of waiting for that shoe to drop.
Yes. And I think they're both built in a similar fashion, wouldn't
yes.
you say? Yes. And I think they both worked for, you know, the thing they're doing. I think The Fugitive is maybe a little bit, you know, more straightforward and less dubious of a picture. I'm not a big fan of Hannibal Lecter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's a cannibal who goes around eating people, but he's a good guy, and I'm not fully on board with that. You know?
He's the anti-hero. He's Venom. Yes.
But there are anti-heroes that I prefer, you know,
uh-huh.
over that. Like the classic spaghetti western, for instance, Clint Eastwood, Blondie.
Right.
He's an anti-hero, and I prefer him.
mm-hmm.
Or Tuco from the same film. Eli Wallach, the ugly
oh,
in that film.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Tuco. You know, when that rope started to tighten, you feel the devil biting your ass. Those are good anti-heroes.
All right. So with that, do we have any more to say on The Fugitive?
If you haven't seen it, watch it.
Yeah. It's a good TNT movie. If you're in a house on a rainy day, it's good.
Pop some popcorn.
Yeah.
Watch an actioner. Yeah.
Yeah. It keeps you invested.
And Harrison Ford is still in his prime. You know, he's mm-hmm. he's still moving. He's still doing his thing with a quick quip, you know.
Yeah, and this was before, you know, the Jack Ryans. And
yeah,
the,
yeah. Yeah, and he was, and so this is actually, if you think about it, in a way, sort of like a proto-Jack Ryan.
Right.
You know, so if you like the Jack Ryans, you'll probably like this. Wouldn't you say?
Actually, let me check and make sure.
That the Jack Ryans came after?
Yeah, I want to say yes.
Was the first one the Patriot Games? No, that was the second one, wasn't it?
Okay, Clear and Present Danger came out in 1994, and then...
So the next year, yeah.
Patriot Games came out before.
Yeah, 92.
So this was during the Jack Ryan era.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, so I was a little wrong. It's my bad.
So he was already doing Jack Ryan when they did The Fugitive.
Yeah.
Okay.
So with that... and also Tommy Jones plays a good character, and this was before he quit giving a shit. Go see The Fugitive.
Like you said, like the rain we've been having and you're stuck inside, watch The Fugitive. It's on HBO this month. Mm-hmm.
Actually, today is the first day where it's been sunny so far.
Right. Well, if the rain comes back, get yourself outside. And then if it comes back, then you watch the Fugitive with some popcorn. Get an animal, sit there, cup of hot cocoa, popcorn. There you go. Watch the movie.
Yep. So with that, that's it for this episode. Next week we are going to do, I think this next one will be our season finale.
Okay. The retrospective is over for the season.
For the summer... It's over.
Cruel summer.
I think we'll do something in October.
Something Halloween related?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm coming up with some ideas. I'm thinking of some things. But we will definitely be back for Christmas for two movies, Mrs. Doubtfire and Die Hard.
Die Hard the first?
The first one.
The Nakajima building?
The Nakatomi building.
Nakatomi building, yeah.
We will be back for those in Christmas.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Yep. And then we'll be... And then, yeah, we're... And we might do a couple more scattered about. I mean, we still... I've been promising the Rambo movies for, like, almost a year. Like, a retrospective on those. But, yeah, we haven't done that yet.
Your good old-fashioned American bloodshed.
Yep. I've been promising those, so maybe they'll come eventually. And then... I don't know what we'll do for Halloween. I wanted to really do something artiste, like... I don't know. I really wanted to do, like, a retrospective of, like, Suspiria or Dario
Argento. Dario Argento. I was going to say Dario Argento. And you could use Dario Argento as a segue into the other
wider realms. The new Suspiria movie.
Or that, or you could do the Italian zombie movies, which were a big thing in the 70s.
Oh, the Lucio Fulci movies?
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
like zombies being eaten by sharks or whatever, you know?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's just what we're thinking of, but, you know, we're going to do...
Cannibal Holocaust. You know, Paul Glaze was going to do that. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever seen it?
I've seen parts of it, and I get real... For whatever reason, those movies that are shot or that were done on, like, 16-millimeter movies,
right.
Like 16-millimeter film, right. Like the Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah.
And this, the Cannibal Holocaust, and those little horror movies.
The little cheap, low-budget guys.
Yeah, that, you know, do it very visceral. It's not, like, super gory, but it's still visceral. It just, it's a little too much for me.
Right, it's too intense. Okay, well, I mean, it was a suggestion. I, you know, have, you know, been into those kind of films in the past, but.
Yeah. And the reason I'm doing this is because I'm not ready to do Freddy Krueger yet. We've been doing, because the last, you know, we've been kind of in a steady trend.
Yeah, Jason. Last year.
So I think we're going to push Freddy Krueger to the Halloween retrospectives of 2019.
Okay.
But we're definitely going to do something for Halloween. I don't know what.
Well, just be thinking on it. And if you want to, you know, let me know. I'll be by to chat if you like.
Yeah, we'll think about it. It might be just some random scary movies. I mean, I would love to do something for Psycho.
Psycho, a seminal film. Yes. Mm-hmm. Not the Vince Vaughn. Van Zandt version.
Oh no! But I think that movie is celebrating a 20th anniversary this year.
Yeah, it was 98 when it first came out. Yeah.
So maybe we might
compare and contrast, or something.
Yeah, do a little compare and contrast. And
guess which one I like better.
Well, let me guess, the 98 version.
Oh, yeah, of course, you know. Vince Vaughn. I'm so hot for that guy.
You know, so. Yeah, so that's just what we're coming up with.
And Heshigan too.
Yeah, as
the main, the first, the victim,
Jet Li character.
Yeah, Jet Li, the victim in the shower.
Oh me, but yeah, we're gonna do something for Halloween, right. And it'll be it'll be decided on in the next month from now, because we want to get started at the end of September.
Right.
And but I think we'll definitely do Suspiria because I love that movie, and also I'm super excited for the new.
Dario Argento is hard to beat, you know, man. Dario Argento is good stuff. So
he is the king of mood.
Yes.
Tone, but yeah. So next week will be the season finale. We are going to do the John Woo, Jean-Claude Van Damme collaboration.
Hard Target.
Yee.
Put some reverb on that.
Oh, I'm going to have some... I'm probably going to have the ground shake. it's going to... So, yeah, we're going to do that, and that'll be it. That'll be all it for right. 93, because, I mean, and not to end 93 on kind of a bummer, because, I mean, there's plenty of stuff we could have done. We could have done Coneheads...
A little bit more of an obscure.
Yeah, we could have done more stuff. Right, we could have done more, but I think we're kind of nearing the end. And also, we're recording at the school here still, and I'm kind of overstepping my boundaries because I don't have a parking pass.
Neither do I.
Well, you gotta get one.
Yes, I will in a couple of days.
So we're gonna just do one more, squeeze one more out of this, and. Then I guess we'll figure out what we're going to do in October and December.
Alrighty, sounds good to me.
All right, thanks everybody. Do you have stuff to plug?
Well, I am really hoping that if you have any post-production needs, I have Adobe Creative Cloud, the whole suite. So if you need Premiere or Animate or After Effects or any of that, you know, audio, video, will work on it. And I have this awesome kick-ass computer. So if you need any post-production stuff, hit me up at Justin Mayhew or alcoolworld@yahoo.com or okay. at the Cardboard Rocket, because I'm really ready. I would love to get some practice, you know, get back into Adobe, because I did a lot with Vegas and stuff like that. So I've got the whole package now, Photoshop, Illustrator, all of it. So
okay, cool. I'll put those links in the description below.
So if you guys need, like I said, if you need help with something, I'm down. I'm ready to go get some practice. Okay.
Cool. And you can follow me on Twitter at MovieKale. You can also follow the show at The Youth Critic. And then you can also follow the channel that distributes this podcast at KHZ Network. Thanks, everyone. We'll be back with you next week for Hard Target.
All right. How was that?
Hold on.
Did you get it, all of it?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, listen up. We have a fugitive that's been on the run for 90 minutes. Average foot speed over uneven ground, barring injury, is 4 miles an hour. That will give you a radius of 6 miles. What I want out of each and every one of you is a hard target search of every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in this area. Checkpoints will go up at 15 miles. Your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball. Go get him.